Ever feel like there's a better way to build? So do we. I'm Matt, and welcome to the Mindful Builder podcast, where we believe in education through storytelling. Join me and my co-host Hamish as we both have a passion for building better, breaking barriers, and sharing our experience within the building industry. We're not pretending to know it all. In fact, we're learning right alongside you. Join us each week as we tackle complex topics like building science and mental well-being, inviting the brightest minds to connect curiosity with expertise. We want this to be a real conversation, encouraging vulnerability through honest discussions. So if you love this podcast and you're ready to join in, learn and build better, please do us a favor and subscribe wherever listening. It's the best way to make sure you never miss an episode, plus it really helps us out. And if you're feeling extra generous, a 5-star rating and a quick review would be amazing. Your support helps us reach new listeners and even better, allows us to book incredible guests for the future episodes. Thank you so much for being part of our community. We truly appreciate you. And now on to this week's episode.
As Matt said, I got my sexy voice on today just for you.
How do you act about that?
It's how he actually always talks to me on the phone, by the way. He always puts this on.
This sexy voice is care of my four-month-old who came home from Canberra with a cold, and I thought I'd dodged it. But apparently not. Here I am. Today, we are joined by Saxon Hall, who is the leading architect.
Yeah, lead architect, principal architect, whatever title you want to give me, really.
Precious. I knew that would be a Hamish going.
So I'm going to excuse my friend Matthew Saxon. He likes to poke the bear whenever he's talking about architects. I don't agree with him.
We'll see if we can enlighten him.
Well, I actually want to get to the first. So I read your form, and I want to get to the point because the way you explained what an architect should know about a builder and what a builder should know about an architect is perfect.
I can't even quite remember the questionnaire that I actually submitted. So
I'll re-jog your memory. It said that builders are always right.
Hey, Saxon, why don't you start off by introducing yourself to the audience?
My name's Saxon Hall. I'm located Hobart, Tasmania. I lead an architectural practice down here called Align Architecture, a few years old. And, we service the whole state of Tasmania and are starting to dabble in some New South Wales and Victorian clients as well. So that's me. And, this is my first ever podcast. So hopefully you've got a good producer who can do some good editing skills and as a fumble way.
Absolutely.
We don't edit anything.
Absolutely.
You've got some cool project locations. You talk about Tassie. You're building or you've designed a house on an island, off an island?
Yeah, we've got a project under construction at the moment with the Zenetto Builders on the east coast of Tasmania. Yeah, it's called Picnic Island. It's located in the Fraser Nay area, and it's a 40 square metre micro build in an extremely remote location. We've got helicopters involved and all those nitty-gritty things to try and get a building built in the middle of nowhere. And, you can sort of – it's pretty unique. Had to adapt very quickly to doing a construction project on a small little island. But, you can find it online and have a squiz. It's pretty interesting.
I've actually been following that one pretty closely. And I don't know, whether Kyle was just more excited about the potential, like social media, like potential for this project, or, he actually was like in with the actual build. But the stuff that him and Maddie Long have been doing with the helicopters and stuff like that has been pretty epic.
I thought it was Kyle just getting a helicopter for the fun of it.
They're like the first discussions around the helicopter situation was like, okay, who's jumping out of this thing into the water? They were pitching stuff like swimming to shore, like with the architectural plans and all kinds of wild stories. But I think, H&S stitched them up a bit, so those plans got scrapped.
It does look like a pretty epic project. But so you guys, I mean, I'll tell you what, if I didn't have a, pretty good business set up in Victoria already, I'd be moving down to Tassie in a heartbeat because some of the locations you guys build on are just incredible.
Yeah, it's I did see you lurking around down here. Maybe was that like 12 months ago or something like that?
I've been down there a couple of times. Yeah, a couple of times.
Yeah. And we've definitely got the luxury of nice locations. These sort of just random projects pop up where people have purchased you know, properties or land in rural remote locations. I did another one down the Tasman Peninsula. Again, had to crane stuff in from Victoria, transportable modular setup, and it was just the same kind of challenges, but super rewarding at the end. So yeah, we do have that luxury.
So let me ask you, you are the son of a builder. How did you get into architecture, and did you ever consider like going down, you know, the hands-on tools path like your father?
Yeah, so that is correct. The old man's a carpenter and still is, like one of those classic carpenters that's just like still driving around in a clapped out Navara that's never been cleaned with like two old toolboxes strapped to the back. I grew up on a lot of construction sites from a young age, just hanging out and, you know, just seeing what's going on before building sites got a little bit more tight regarding OH&S. But I was definitely exposed to a lot of carpentry and you know, timber works and all that. And I kind of had this bit of artistic sort of side to me as well. So I was kind of always sitting in that cusp of like creativity versus like, you know, building. And I ended up sort of slotting into a housing and design course in college and then kind of just rolled straight into, you know, environmental design, which then rolled straight into a master's of architecture. And it kind of just evolved. But, you know, dad was always on to me. Like he was just like, you know, if you're going to go to architecture school, you know, you've got to have at least minimum 2 years on the construction side or, you know, working for a builder to know what you're doing. I was like, yeah, right. And I never really jumped on board probably that as early as I should have, but I did get to the point where I was like, you know, I'm going to, you know, spend some time working under a builder, and I did that. But that's kind of how I landed in it. Never knew.
Tell me more about that. I want to know more about working for a builder, because Liam from Hit V Height made the comment when he come on that too much time with architect courses is spent on random architects and whatnot, but not enough time is spent on site. And I feel like that is so valuable, especially when we talk about respect, and we'll get that, the conversation builders and architects probably love each other but hate each other. It's a bit of a weird relationship. But I feel like that bridges the gap so much.
Yeah, it did. It was a pretty mind-boggling experience. And, you know, I'm not saying in a sense that I went and, like, you know, strapped on the tool belt and attempted to construct anything. I was more sort of slotted into the, you know, learning estimation and project management side of things. It was real eye-opening. I actually chose to do that. I came out of working for more of a sort of high-end sort of level residential architectural firm with a traditional architectural process, straight into like dabbling in experience with a builder for 2 years, right at like that tail end of like coming off COVID, where like in Tassie and probably Victoria as well, like the building market and the costs of everything were just skyrocketing and they were just out of control. And I was like straight into the crux of like learning estimating and project management, right on the tail end of the COVID situation, and just seeing prices just skyrocket, trying to manage clients and budgets and actually contract jobs. It was a wild experience, but definitely didn't ease into it. But yeah, learned a lot. The estimating thing was probably the biggest thing I took away from it, getting a really good understanding of like how things are costed and those things that if you haven't got estimating experience, you kind of, and you're just doing architecture, things might slip over. You think things cost X amount of dollars, but you're not considering sort of A, B, and C. So I reckon the estimating thing was the biggest thing I took away from it that helps me in today's process here at Align, I reckon.
Do you still comment on the build cost when you're involved in a project now, or you leave that up to the builder?
Oh, no, definitely not. So our process that we've developed here at Align, which we're continually sort of refining as we're moving along, we use like a different kind of a sort of process of bringing builders on in projects, and we bring builders on a lot earlier in our projects, really from day dot. We actually get our builders in through like a negotiated contract process as opposed to like a tendering process. So we find a suitable builder for our client basically on day one before we've even put pen to paper, and they're involved in three critical estimating processes through the project, one right at the start, sort of one after the concept is developed, and then right at the end before we contract the job. So we basically do that estimation process with our builder. We sit down with our builder and we go through the detailed estimate before we've met with our clients and make sure that we've fleshed out any ideas for cost savings or swapping things around. And I think, yeah, that process has like literally given us the best results. I haven't been in the industry for a whole lot of time, like, you know, 10 to 12 years in the architectural profession, but I can safely say the process that I'm doing now with early contractor involvement and negotiating contracts has paid off hugely for us in the last few years.
Why do you think there's still resistance against the negotiated tender model?
Tasmania is especially hard. We're in a very small community down here, and I have seen a lot of sort of people stuck in their ways in terms of going down a tendering sort of path. And I think that it's been hard for people to break away and really see the value in just, you know, working with a builder that's transparent, that everyone can trust and that can work together from day one, and they've got the catalogue of data to be able to understand costs from day one. And I don't know if I've got an answer for you, Matt, in sense of why other people haven't jumped on as quickly as I can, but, you know, as I think they should. But maybe it's just they can't sort of see that, you know, if you can compare apples with apples and show, like, the process, the time and the cost associated with a tendering process versus a negotiated contract, and you put them side by side like a case study, I think that would, you know, show a bit more transparency that it can pay off. I really want to see the whole industry in Tasmania really level up in terms of how they're working through their design process and their contract negotiations with clients versus the traditional processes. But yeah, if anyone's out there and wants to, you know, ever pick up the phone and talk to me about it, I'll chew their ear off about, yeah, how it's worked good for us, because I've had the most success, during that process.
The same can be said for, you know, me and Matt might ask the question of probably most of the builders in Australia and why they aren't building, you know, durable, healthy homes that are also energy efficient and, you know, beautiful to live in. You know, we've drunk the Kool-Aid because we've chosen to go down that path. I actually think it comes down to the fact that people just don't know. You know, if you look at, and again, this is absolutely just my opinion on the situation. If you look at what architects are taught at school, they're taught design. Like the first, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is my understanding of it. The first 2 or 3 years, it's all about just design with no limitations. You know, just design. Don't think about what councils are saying. Don't think about things structurally. So just have that freedom of designing. And it's, you know, and they're told, well, I don't think they're taught how to cost projects or understand really how things go together and actually the value of the things that they're designing. So I personally don't blame architects, or if there is, you know, a blame to be put somewhere, I don't necessarily blame architects for not knowing what things cost, because they're not taught how things are cost. But just in that right there, if you think about what we do as builders, we cost projects all the time. So we have an idea of what things cost. And I think, like, my biggest beef of the whole thing is when I get told by someone that that's too expensive, when all I really want to say is, no, I'm not expensive. The design's expensive, because I'm just quoting what I'm looking at in front of me. And again, I'm absolutely not blaming the architect or architects or designers or whoever, that prices are outside of what the client wants to spend. I just think everyone needs to understand where their inputs were acquired in the process. So maybe that's just my roundabout way of kind of segueing into, you know, the builder, the architect that you work for and the company you work for, because you're owned by a builder. You know, Aligned Architecture is owned by a builder. Mate, can you just talk to us a little bit about Aligned Architecture and its setup? And just for the record, if no one has seen Aligned projects before, I've been watching these guys for a few years now. And, you know, I've been following Luke Davies for a while. Like, we're not talking about builder design homes. We're talking about architecturally designed homes. So they are beautiful homes to look at and live in.
Yeah. So That's correct. The company was founded, yeah, by a builder. And Luke sort of, you know, evolved the business off the back of, I suppose, frustrations and things that he'd learned, you know, mistakes that had been learned along the way. So he basically wanted a solution where the architectural process, you know, was basically focused not just on the client relation, but integrating the builder in at the same time. And it's gone through a few different variations before it's got to where it is now. But essentially it's about, you know, it's called the ABC method. So it's a bit corny, but it's called the aligned build collaboration method. So it's having, you know, the homeowner, the builder and the architect sort of all in the one mix at the sort of one time, and the builder being involved from as early on in the design processes as possible. So, yeah, to answer the first part of your question, that's sort of where it stemmed from. Kind of forgot the second part of your question already.
So, right, I kind of went on a bit of a ramble there for a bit, but I reckon I've been watching Matt. I reckon he's got something to say right now because he keeps unmuting his microphone.
I kind of want to go back to the whole negotiated tender. I have a few problems with it that from a builder's perspective, and I'm going to talk only from a builder's perspective here. The issue I hate is when you get an architect question the fee to be involved in the project. Like, oh, why are you charging? Or do you give it back if the project goes ahead? And my response at the moment to that is, do you give your money back if the design doesn't go ahead because it's over budget? Didn't really sit well with the person I said that to.
No, I didn't imagine so.
But that's the reality. Like I'm going to ask questions that they're kind of loaded, but it's good to get an architect's perspective on it because for some reason, architects listen to architects and builders listen to builders and some builders listen to architects and some architects listen to builders. But I want to get an architect's perspective on it.
Yeah, well, I suppose my perspective on it is like, because again, I came back to that experience of that couple of years working in the pressure cooker, estimating project management. I saw firsthand how long it took for a builder to be involved early in a project, and the amount of time that I had to personally sink into, you know, estimating projects. And so it was at that point I was like, oh, I understand now. Like, this takes a lot of time. So, like, I'm starting to work with a few other builders in the Hobart area that are just starting to come on board the process, and a few of them, we do what's called a pre-build feasibility at the very, very first part of the project before anyone's signed any agreements, anyone's put any pen to paper, and it just outlines all the costs associated with all the architectural design, the interior design, the council, the consultants, and fees from builders. And, you know, I actually encourage any of the new builders that come on board this process. I'm just like, yeah, you guys have got to charge a fee for your time. You've got to charge it at the concept design stage when you take away the drawing set to do an estimate, and you need to charge for it at the end because time is money. And there's no way that the fee that's put forward covers off the amount of time that you guys have got to sink into trying to get a job contracted. But at least it does two things. It covers off on a little bit of that time, and it actually just shows a financial commitment from the owner to the builder that, hey, these guys are serious. We're all in it to go through to the end and to get a project built for you, you know, on budget. So the small financial commitment shows that, hey, you know, the owners and clients are keen, the builder's serious. And if you ever get a client that turns their nose at like a, you know, whatever the fee is, it's quite a small amount, you probably know, well, we could be in for a little bit of a rough trot here if they're not wanting to pay a builder a small fee to spend their time estimating. So I've got quite a positive spin on it, but I have heard within the industry down here that there is a few other architects that are starting to become aware of the fees that estimating fees that builders are sort of charging to cover off in their time, because time is money, you know, like, you can't expect people to work for free. I'm not going to work for free. You guys aren't going to work for free. So
we still are. We're still not charging what it costs. So this is what I'm going to say to Haim. How many hours do you think you put into a project from the start to the end before it gets to site?
So I can speak to this because we've just done a whole bunch of data collection on it. Dan and Robert would spend about 200 hours doing the pre-construction phase. to get to the point where we're delivering a price. And then there's usually another 40 to 60 hours from the moment we give a price to the time we actually get to site, because that might involve a little bit of value management. We might need to be assisting the design team with report and consents or building permit considerations. We might need a construction management plans, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm also spending about 16 hours in our what we call our feasibility phase. So that's where I'm actually involved with getting some quick build estimates together for the client. So what are we up to, about
286 hours.
Quick maths.
$150 would be a very low amount for a consultant in any field.
Let's do 150, and I think that's on the low side.
That's $42,900, and a builder's going to charge maybe $10,000 to $12,000, maybe 15.
Yeah, so a small portion, and like I said,
more than half.
I have heard a lot of people or a lot of builders down here just starting to get to that point where they're just like, we only do a negotiated contract process. We're not, like, if they have a tender land on their desk, they're like, no thanks. Because their chances are significantly dropped of winning the project.
It's a race to the bottom.
Yeah. If they're doing a negotiated process, their chances are higher. If they do our process where we're bringing them on from day dot, their chances of signing on that job are extremely high. So, it's pretty interesting, and it's hot discussion down here at the moment.
And the build price at the same, the tender to negotiate tender, is probably the same price.
I mean, yeah, I think I can intellectually understand why someone would want to go to tender, because they'd want to see a spread of prices. Like, I totally understand that. We're actually encouraging clients to, at our feasibility stage, chat with two or three builders. You know, they might talk to Matt, they might talk to Mark from MVH. And I'm like, look, at this stage, expect to pay between $500 and $1,500 to get someone to give you an opinion of cost at that point in time. It's at that stage, maybe spread, you know, hedge your bets a little bit there. You might be spending a little bit more money now, but you're getting a spread of where the industry is saying that your project is going to be benchmarked at. At Sanctum Homes, we've kind of shortcut that a little bit by doing an in-house costing, and we're also sending it out to Priceaplan to do a QBE as well. So we are getting two independent prices, one from us and one from outside. But we're encouraging clients to talk to builders and get them, you know, and we're suggesting talk to builders of the level that we're, the product that we're, you know, going to be delivering. So I might say, talk to Matt, talk to Mark, talk to Dylan, talk to these guys, because they're going to deliver a similar product to us and see where they think the project's going to land. But, you know, once we go into that pre-construction phase where we're spending those 2 to 250 hours, like, that's when we want to make sure that all the time that we're putting into this project is actually resulting us delivering you a project on budget or what you want to spend, but also getting it to site.
But we also have passive house knowledge, Haim. Like, you've built a hempcrete house that if someone's coming to you for a hempcrete house, they need your expertise. Like, that project most likely doesn't go ahead correctly or well without that. And the fact that, let's just call it $150, if you went that to an open market, someone's going to charge $300, $400, $500 an hour.
I know you guys are supposed to be asking me questions, but my kind of question on this is, if there's any other architects that are watching this, I don't know if you have many architects that watch this podcast, it's just like, they're probably thinking, what about a quantity surveyor or an external cost consultant? Why can't we just use, you know, a consultant like that at those same points to get the same result? And I'm always intrigued to know from other people in the industry, how does that slot into the process? Does it work? Is it just something that's not even acknowledged? Is it ever accurate?
A quantity surveyor bases their data off historical values. That's how they get their numbers. So by the time that they quote the project at the start, it's usually confirmation bias for everyone to be like, yeah, it's validated, so we can go ahead and charge our fee. But the thing is, when the builder quotes, it's an estimate based on the real cost at that real time, based on that job specifically, and a lot more detailed. So from that, it's like they give the recipe, but you're the checkout at the checkout counter at this grocery store getting the real amount of what it's going to cost, kind of thing.
My thoughts are that I think quantity surveyor and cost planners, you know, they have a space, and you know, I think it's valuable, but I also know that, you know, being part of, you know, Future Builder, that every single one of us, and even talking to my network, every single one of us has a break-even point for our overheads. It might be between 12 and it might be at 70%, 17% markup. So how, and then obviously from there, we then need to make money. So our markup might be 25, 30%. How is that being taken into consideration when someone's coming in and not knowing the spread of builders that are going to be involved in the project to cost them? So I think the fairest way to do it would be to get cost plan, but take out supervision, take out project management, take out contract admin, and then take out any markup. And then you get builders come in and then say, well, my business structure needs X, Y, and Z, and I'm thinking that we need a supervisor on it 50% of the time, so I'm going to be allowing X amount for that project, and I know my markup needs to be 25% before I even start making money. So that's where I think you can see some variance in when you get a cost planner or a quantity surveyor involved, and then you might get two or three builders quote the job.
It's still historical data though. So that project might not go ahead for 18 months. They're basing their data at that point on only three-year-old data.
Yeah. My experience, because I've obviously used quantity surveyors and cost consultants prior to using this process that we're talking about now with Align, but my experience has been that when I've had quantity surveyors do estimates on jobs, they're just a document that arrives in email. They're usually coming in pretty hot early on in the project. And what I've had is you present that to the client, and what I've seen is just instant freak out. Pull the pin on the job. There goes my work. There goes any future builder's work, whatever. And they've sort of storm off pretty frustrated with where it is. What I find with working one-on-one with a builder, negotiating a price, okay, we still have some prices coming that are not aligned with the client's budget, but at least, you know, I do this with, you know, the guys from Into Construction down here in Hobart all the time. If we have something that's coming a little bit hot, we'll sit down the week before, we'll go, okay, it's coming in a little bit hot. What's our strategies? What are we going to do to try and go into this meeting with solutions early on? And we can literally put them side by side and actually develop a strategy and go on with solutions, and then come out of the meeting with a client that's feeling okay, that we've got it under control. Where the cost consultancy documents, you don't have that personal connection and relationship, and that you can actually pull that off. So yeah.
I mean, I was about to use a really crude analogy here, but I'm going to use it anyway. I kind of feel like a cost consultant or a feasibility study is like making love with no foreplay, because it's just like, bang, there it is, you know, like it or lump it. Whereas I kind of feel like, I see you laughing about it. I love what you're saying there. Like, we're literally going through a process at the moment where we've done feasibility on a job and we're now sitting quite high where we want it to be. And now Dan and I in pre-con, we want a list of items that we can go back to the client with. And this is in consultant with the designer and architect as well. Go, hey, we know we're over. We're not just going to say, well, like it or lump it. We're like, well, this is how we're proposing to bring it back down. You don't have that same relationship when you're using a cost planner or a quantity surveyor, because I kind of feel like they're just checking boxes. All right, another job come in, here's the number. Next job come in, here's the number. There's no emotion attached to it. Like, I know for me, like, I've got a lot of integrity in what we do. So if my original feasibility is lower than what that cost is, like, you bet your bloody ass that I'm working really hard to get that down or come up with solutions. But this is where that, like, true collaboration comes into it. Like, Like all the things that you're saying right now just ring so true to
the approach that we take. What's your go-to saying?
Oh, well, the go-to saying is the architect gets their project built, the client gets a beautiful home, and the builder makes money. That's a successful project.
Back to what you said earlier, Hamish, about I think you might have said like, you know, tendering a project, like you don't blame the client for wanting to tender a project. That's a really valid point, and I kind of put myself in those shoes. If I was a client and I was doing my own home, I'd probably think about that as well. But I think what's important here is that we're only sort of working with builders that we know that are honest and super transparent. And, you know, between myself and Mitch, who's also in the business, who actually was an estimator for multiple years, and our builders being fully open book, like they're getting to the point now where they're just laying all costs out the table. Like we're talking about a 9-12 page document, which literally shows every single cost associated with every single fixing, finish, labor, the whole lot. It's like, what's all out on the table there. There's nothing to hide. We can all see it. We've got the experience behind us to be able to break down those costs, ask the questions that we need. The client's got it. They get emailed it after the meeting with all those figures.
But you get it, though.
Going to the full extent of showing their upmark, you know. It's getting pretty good. So there's no excuse. Like, if it's all out on the table, no one's hiding anything. That's what it costs.
You get it because you've been on the back end. The issue that we have is like, oh, but this other builder did it instead of $80. He was doing it $75. Can you do $75?
Yeah. Mitch in the business also has this comment. He says, like, all builders cost the same. It's just like how transparent a builder and how much they want to show early on. Like at the end of the day, whether you pay for it honestly and openly in a lump sum at the start, or whether it's undercut and you pay for it in variations, they're going to end up at the same price. It's just where you pay it and how much frustration you have to deal with from a client's point of view. So, yeah, look, how you get that message through to the broader communities, it's gonna be a big thing when someone can pull that off on a broader scale.
I certainly don't want, you know, any architect listening to this to think that, you know, we're right and they're wrong. Like, and I certainly don't want to be coming across like that to you either. But I guess what I will say is, like, we're the one, they're on the ground executing it. We're building it. We're actually seeing the real-time cost of what things cost us. And you know what? If at the end of the job,
we hold the risk too.
And we hold the risk too. You know, and this is a recent thing for us at Sanctum Homes the last couple of years. Like, we've been really trying to dial in our like actual category costing in our projects, like, so we can actually see, you know, where we're winning and where we're losing, or where we need to adjust our costing. And that's feeding back into real time, because we might have four projects on at once, but then we might be costing another wave of projects at certain stages. So we can actually, we're constantly feeding that data back into what we're doing. So, I mean, I think I personally feel there's real value in that, because, like, look, as an architect or a client, the last thing that you want to happen is your builder to go broke, because that is an absolute shit show. Mm. Like, you want the builders to make money. So my question to you, Saxon, like, how do we solve this problem? Like, I think the problem being that the default for architects is to go to tender.
We've got to educate the broader community. And I'm on the same page, Hamish. I'm not saying that this is, you know, I'm not going to sit here and preach that this is the only way to do something. It's like there's many ways to skin a cat, as they say. This is just a process that I've sort of fallen into that works for me and works for the team. And we've had quite good success through it. And I'm not making those comments out of what I think. Like, I know it was only 2 short years that I was in that building industry, but I was in the position where I was working for a builder in the same city I'm designing in, and I'm seeing inquiries and projects come in from external designers, right? And I'm assessing and estimating those, and I'm seeing them fall over in front of me. So it's not like, yeah, this is off like personal experience, but how we teach people that want to know about this process and and sort of stepping into this new kind of negotiated style. It's just about educating. We've got to just educate, and anyone out there, I encourage them to always pick up the phone and have a chat to me about how we're doing it.
The education's there, though. I think people also turn a blind eye to it. Like, they come on, like, everyone's on social media these days or can pick up a blog or listen to a podcast. The information's there. They choose not to listen to it. It's like, let's go to Passive House, for an example, or high performance building. Tell me what part of it doesn't make sense that people continually choose not to go down that path.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think what I've seen in the design industry for Passive House is this perception that if you're going down the Passive House direction, it like eliminates that opportunity for those higher end poetic architectural concepts that might have a negative effect on the performance of the home. Does that kind of make sense? Like, I've just got some comments.
That's been dispelled though, hasn't it? Surely.
It's just like, I think people's perception is like, if you're going to build a passive home, it's just got to be like a square or rectangle with like a simple roof and some windows slapped on the side of it. And then that, like, anything that you try and do out of that is going to cause problems for certification.
My take on that is, like, yes, some buildings are a lot easier to certify than others. That's truth. That is 100% truth. But my challenge that I'm throwing out to architects is, use Passive House as just another site constraint. Like, if you've got a building over here or tree there, or you can't build to the boundary, you've got certain setbacks or whatever, these are all site constraints that you need to then apply to your response to the design. Passive House is just another constraint. So it should be up to the designer to then come up with a solution of how do you then layer this thing called Passive House, this constraint called Passive House, into the design and make it beautiful. Like, don't blame Passive House for not being able to deliver a beautiful architectural project.
It's just another, a challenge that you've got to work your way through. I'm doing a pretty big Passive House down here in Hobart, which I can comfortably say is the most architecturally concept-driven, poetic project that I've ever done in my short career, 10, 12 years, whatever we want to call it. It's got all those conceptual ideas that you see, you know, in quite rich architectural projects, but they're going for the highest level of Passive House certification, possible. And, you know, I hope that when that gets done, that can be used as a bit of a case study to the community to say, hey, you know that Passive House thing you're scared about? No, you can still do this style of design. You can still have these crazy concepts or whatever you want in this home and still pull it off.
So you've mentioned it a couple of times as we talk today, but it's also come up a couple of times in the form we got you to fill out. But you referred to poetic nature of architecture. And I love those words put together like that. Could you maybe explain what you mean when you say never lose sight of the poetic nature of architecture?
When you talked about architecture school earlier on, it's just like the purpose of what architecture school is. It's all driven around creativity and design, and it's an artistic form. It's an artistic creation. All those basic things about learning about costs and council and consultants, that all comes after the fact. And it's kind of sometimes hard for people to grasp, but if you apply those really artistic, conceptual, poetic ideas to a home, so say whether it's some kind of idea that's driven by a connection to the landscape we're in. So, for example, the Hillcrest Rise project that I'm doing, which is the Passive House one in Tolman's Hill, which is not too far from where we are, I've connected the whole idea of the form and the materials and everything to do with the building has this real strong connection to the organ pipes and the stone formations on the mountain behind. So that's like an example when whether it's like a material I'm picking or the shape of bathroom joinery or the proportions of windows, all those like fluffy things that you might think are not important. If you apply that thinking to the whole design process from the bigger, broader conceptual ideas right down to the kitchen joinery and the shape of the handles and the material that you've picked, what you end up with is this sort of project that has an end result that it flourishes in a way that it provides these opportunities for the client that they never thought of, whether it's a space they're sitting in, drinking a cup of tea in the morning, and they're getting filtered light through windows, and they just have a sense of calm. Like capturing those things in the design and hanging on to them all the way through, just, you know, it creates this like amazing thing. And that's what I'm sort of trying to grasp is they're the things that architects love because they're creatives and they're artistic. And those things and passive house high performance can go hand in hand. And I'm out to prove it so that the community down here can see that, yeah, we want to get on board this and how do we do it?
But that's what we want. We want architects to be architects and be creative. Leave the building and costings to us. Go be even more creative and we'll deal with the performance side for you. We'll deal with that side of things for you.
Before we go too further on that point, Matt, I actually think that, and sorry to interrupt for a second, but Saxon, your explanation of why we need to not lose sight of the poetic nature of architecture, I think how you explained that was so beautiful, by the way. Even though that comment,
poetic
nature of architecture, I think is the most wanky architect thing to say.
Yeah,
I actually believe in everything that you've just said, because that becomes the narrative for when their client's friends come over and you're pointing all that stuff out. And these things really shouldn't be, in one sense, they should be really obvious, but in another sense, they should just make sense when you go into a home. And it might just be a bit of a side comment saying, oh, yeah, that's really drawing on, you know, the flutes of that particular mountain range behind. Like, that should just be a side comment. But you should go into a home that just feels right. And without architects, we don't have any of that. We have just boxes on a block of land and then we just rinse and repeat.
To tie this together, Matt, I think your comments are very valid in saying that, like, we need to constantly, and I do this and I remind the team of this, to tap in to the experts that know what they're doing. So whether it's the builder that's managing cost and buildability, whether it's, you know, the team at Harvey Norman that know their stuff about appliances, whether it's the joiner that knows how joinery goes together, or the lighting supplier, use those people that are experts in that field to bring it all together, because a lot of people, I think, try and take all that on themselves to try to be the experts in everything, whether it's sanitary wear, whether it's estimating construction costs. But there's other people out there that can do it 10 times better than you. So don't be afraid to jump on them and use them as you need. It's real important.
Where do you think builders go wrong with architects? I sit here and jokingly take the piss out of architects. I find it fun and it seemed to poke the bear and get them going. But let's go to the flip side. Where do you think builders go wrong?
There's a few projects where, unfortunately, we don't get the opportunity to be involved in the construction process. For whatever reason it is, it might be a contractual thing, a mechanism that doesn't allow us to be heavily involved. It might be a finance thing where maybe the clients have just, they've spent a fair bit of coin and they're not ready to pay an architect for 12 months or 8 months to be involved. So in that situation, we stepped back and maybe we might only turn up for a couple of site visits to view progress. But where I think builders sometimes go wrong is they will take it into their own hands to swap or substitute something, thinking about the compounding effect that it has on something. So say, for example, I'm real like notorious for, you know, swapping out, for using like a timber cladding profile, which is, I call it inverted board and batten. So rather than the sort of a traditional board and batten process, you've flipped it on its back so that you've got the wider covering board at the front and the shallower backing board. And I actually grasped hold of that from my my previous architectural office at Morrison and Bradenbach, where I learned that technique, and they taught that to me. And it increases the airflow behind all the cladding. It gives more distance for movement in this climate where we have extreme colds and super hot summers. And this is just one example, but then like a builder would go out on a limb and say, oh, we're going to swap that out for a shiplap V-group for cladding because it costs X amount of dollars less. But then I've seen firsthand that in this environment, like shiplap doesn't track well in this environment. The secret fixings don't have as much room to move. We've seen shiplap popping out, window flashings and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And it's probably going to, that could have a ramification down the line. So, like, there's a reason I specified that inverted board and batten. Just because it looks similar to shiplap, don't just go swap it out to save someone $6,000. Like, I put it there for a reason. So there's probably heaps of different examples, but that's just one that I've seen happen a few times on a few different projects. It's like, get rid of the inverted board and batten. Just
that's frustrating.
Getting some shiplap that I got on special from Mitre 10 at the time.
I think the conversation still exists, though, like that as a builder in that pre-construction process, like I think we should have agency to say, hey, you know what, I've got this other cladding option, particularly when we're going down that value management path. I think that conversation should still exist. However, it needs to be respectful, and then you need to understand why that particular cladding was sought out in the first place. But that's where the true collaborative process comes into it. It's not just the builder going, hey, client, I could save you $6,000. It's like, hey, let's all have a conversation here around why this cladding exists as it is now and what are the ramifications, what are the pros and cons of maybe switching to a different one. And I think, one, you can't get that if you just did that typical, bid-build kind of process where it's going to tender. But you can actually have these conversations along the way before you get to site. So by the time you get to site, everything's resolved. You as the architect is really happy with the end outcome. The client's happy with the end outcome and the builder's comfortable where the price sits.
I can't get my head around swapping it out without asking the question. And I know the architect that I share an office with, she's had that problem multiple times. And I'm like, I'm confused. Like it's on the documentation, the contract. Why is it changing? The building surveyor should also pull them up on it.
Yeah, that's another good point. Building surveyors have really been tightening their belt here in Tassie over the last few years. But from what I heard, there was quite a big claim situation on a certain project, that caused a bit of an insurance hike for everyone in the industry, and it took a few out, and then the others that have remained are being a lot more cutthroat with things. So if something's changing from the building approval docs, we now have to go through the process of updating the architectural documentation, recertifying the drawings and resubmitting it back for approval, where, five years ago, builders could swap things out on site. It'd get inspected and it gets signed off and on your merry way. So people need to be aware of that. As soon as you're, like Matt said, as soon as you're changing something on those documents, you could be opening up. Like, and then who's paying for that? Who's paying for us to readjust the drawings, recertify? So it can cause a few headaches.
I actually, on my own house, I shrunk my deck by 200 mil. So I went to the building surveyor and I had to go back and get a report and the secondary consent from council because they needed to approve it, which I was like, this is ridiculous. Like we've got slightly off topic, but the NCC isn't a problem of why things take forever. It's councils. But I agree, we've got to have somewhere to go back and there's got to be a good train to keep everything moving as per the drawing at the start. Sorry, I've got a crying baby in the background.
I can hear Matt's crying baby in the background.
Yeah, but I want to loop back to the start a little bit too. Going back to your dad being a carpenter, when you told him about passive house, what did he say?
Oh, this is the fuel you're looking for. Look, I find with a lot of those builders that are out of the city and, they're out the sticks or they're out the East Coast, I talk a lot about even the discussion around vented cavities and cavity batten systems. You get the old, what do you mean? Nah, we've been doing stuff like this for 20, 30 years and you don't need that. And then the time that I told Dad, I was just like, cladding's like not your weatherproofing. Like, your weatherproofing is your WIB. Like, I said, the cladding's just the rain screen. He lost it when I said that. He was just like, what do you mean the cladding's a rain screen? Couldn't understand it. So I haven't even gone down the path of passive house discussions.
Does he get it yet?
Nah, I talked to him about air tightness and mechanical ventilation, and he's like, oh, I don't know about that. You know, I think you just need to open your windows.
My favorite one was you ask them why, and it just unravels them. Like, why don't you need the ventilator cavity? Because why?
But I actually want to get your dad on, Saxon. I'd love to get like just someone else. I mean, obviously, like right now, the three of us are just yelling into an echo chamber, right? Like we're all agreeing with what everything's saying, and you know we're going to walk away from this feeling that we solved all the problems. But the reality is, there are builders out there who think differently to us. There's architects out there who think differently to us. There's old chippies who just want to keep doing it the same way that they're doing. I don't really know where I'm going with this, but it'd be great to get, you know, some guests on here that are actually challenging what we're thinking, because we could just, you know, get so focused on, well, how we're doing it's the right way to do it. I think it is good to get challenged sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Just a side note on that, back to the Picnic Island project, the cabin on an island off an island, that client specifically, when I talked about passive house and mechanical ventilation, they kind of said, you know, like, we're building a shack, you know, a cabin on Tasmania. Like, we want to open the windows. We want to feel that cool breeze. We want to experience that being in a remote location and feeling those kind of elements. And that's a very valid point itself, coming back to the poetic nature. That's a conceptual poetic comment that a client's wanting to feel and experience a certain, you know, a certain thing on that project. And I think that has its place, you know.
But you can open your windows. You just get to choose when you want to open them. Exactly. I had mine right behind me yesterday. This is going to be certified very shortly. I literally had them open all day yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
So at the start, you got a project with Kyle at the moment?
Yeah, we've got a couple under construction and some coming up as well, yeah. Yep.
And you obviously work with Luke with his Davies construction as well?
Yeah, right? Yep. Had some projects with Luke. We've got some projects with Intuit Constructions with Peter and Jason down here in Hobart, and Zach Haley at Compatible Construction down here in Hobart as well. We've got a handful of builders that, you know, come to us. And
so who's more fun to work with, Kyle or Luke?
Oh, that's a good question. Luke's that busy. I don't actually talk Luke that much, because he's so busy obviously with future builders, and he's been away a fair bit this year. So, look, I think Kyle and Matt, you know, Pierce, who's down here in Hobart, we do have a laugh. We do have a laugh. They are fun. Sometimes have to pull them back in line here and there, but
I'm not surprised by that one. I'm shocked. Wow.
Do you know what? Having been mates with Luke and Kyle independently for a couple of years, I think that both businesses are great builders.
It was a loaded question. I didn't think you were actually going to answer it.
They definitely have different personalities, though, that's for sure. And I'm sure if your clients were coming to you, whether they went Davies or because they're NATO builders, they're going to get a great result, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now, they need to realize, that sometimes I catch them a bit off guard, where I'm just like, yeah, okay, I've taken off my fun hat now, and I've actually put on my contract hat. So let's be serious for an hour, and then I can put back on my fun hat after that. And I think that's real important. Builders being able to put on different hats when they need to step out of their contractual obligations and talk about something else, and then put that contractual, you know, hat back on. That's one of the
I had that conversation with James from Alter Eco today, and I said the reason I love working with him is that we can have a really hard conversation, and then 2 seconds later, it's not personal. It's just we both want the same outcome. So it's to the point conversation. We want to make sure the project's viable. So we have the very hard, difficult, straight conversation, and then 2 minutes later, we're talking about what we did on the weekend.
Exactly, and that's an important skill set for architects and builders to be able to know when to take off one hat, put on another, and everything's okay.
Now, even though you're not, you guys are based down in Tassie, you are starting to service the mainland as well, and I know we've you know, we've been pretty keen to get a line and Sanctum Harvest project together, and I reckon that'll happen, you know, not in the near distant future. So if you are around Australia wanting to engage a really great architect, how could people get in contact with you guys?
Yeah, they can just jump online and just punch in Google align.build, and they'll probably find their website. You've got an inquiry form there and you can just submit away. We're registered in Victoria and New South Wales, and I think we're pre-qualified in Queensland as well. So,
are you able to call yourself an architect in Melbourne or Victoria because builder's not like the director? How does that, I don't know how that works, because isn't a little bit tiptoey with that sort of side of things?
So in terms of, you mean in terms of working in Victoria, is it a problem?
Yeah, like you got to be very careful who calls who an architect. Is that, am I right?
Oh, yes, yeah. That, no, you actually do. Yeah. That is a thing that's always a hot discussion is, basically, to cut a long story short, if you haven't studied architecture and you haven't been registered by a board, which is a pretty hard process to do, then you can't go around calling yourself an architect. Otherwise, you get slapped with a $20,000 fine. So true fact. Yeah,
I wasn't just giving a shout out to homeowners then. I was actually giving a shout out to builders as well, because I know you guys also, you know, really encourage builders sort of partnering up for that kind of DC process too. So it was actually a shout out to builders and homeowners wanting to, you know, catch up with you guys, because I know we've kind of explored a couple of different options and, you know, both have, you know, great outcomes in my opinion. So, you know, if you are a builder or a homeowner, you know, no matter where you are in Australia, like I'd strongly encourage you to reach out to a line. What else you got, Maddie?
No, I'm trying to work on my PR to repair my relationship with architects. I did speak to Hamish about a series on like honest truths, and we're just going to go very open book on what we think builders doing wrong, architects, building surveyors, interior designers, and just it's not from a negative place. Some will take it from a negative place. It's actually to help the industry improve and just do this whole, you're doing this wrong and you need to change this because this isn't working.
Exactly. We've got a bit of a joke in the office. Whenever someone gets in a debate about some building science related question, we had one in the office a few months ago, treated pine versus standard pine battening. I was just like, you know, hey, Sarah, send Maddie a message on Instagram and ask him. Just hoping that I just throw a hand grenade into Instagram and just explode the chat group. But I don't know.
I love taking the piss out of the steel building industry too. They really bite. They get so defensive. And that's the best one to ask why, and they have nothing.
Hey, anyway, I've got a meeting. I've got a meeting after this, and I'm about to lose my voice. So it's really been great chatting, Saxon.
Thanks for putting your sexy voice on, Haim.
I'm actually catching up with an architect after this, so hopefully I can woo them with my sexiness.
Make sure you put your turtleneck sweater on too.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks. Thank you. Bye. Cheers.